calling the HHS Policy Committee to order. Remember, today's agenda is all non-cost policy proposals from the Department of Health, plus one additional non-cost bill from Representative Cantrell. We do have a quorum, though? We have a quorum. We'll be kind of jumping back and forth as members have other bills and other committees. So I believe we're going to start with Representative Hewitt's bill. And while he's joining us at the testifiers table, may I have a motion to approve the minutes
for
March 3rd? Thank you, Representative Fisher. On the motion to approve the minutes, all in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hewitt, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an author's amendment, so would you like to move your bill and then your amendment?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt moves. Sorry. Proceed, Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 3794 be recommended for placement on the General Registry. I would also like to move the A2 author's amendment.
Representative Hewitt moves the A2 author's amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Hewitt, please present your bill.
Madam Chair, committee members, the Department of Health is responsible for regulating the use of operation of X-ray equipment and other sources ionizing product radiation. The bill makes two policy changes. These policy issues were discovered in the course of the department's ongoing X-ray rulemaking. First, there are certain professionals who are authorized under the scope of practice to operate X-ray equipment and who are admitted from the X-ray statute. The changes in this bill list these individuals who are authorized to operate X-ray systems. This aligns with the industry's best practices. The second, qualified practitioners who are currently authorized to operate X-ray systems are listed according to the health-related board that governs their active practice authority. Finally, in addition, the policy changes mentioned above this bill makes a number of housekeeping and plain language updates. I have testifiers here if there are any questions to the bill.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3794? Is there discussion from the committee? Okay, there being no further discussion, Representative Hewitt renews his motion that House File 3794, as amended, be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3794, as amended, is recommended for placement on the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to now take up House File 3928, which is Representative Brand's bill, but Representative Vang is going to begin the presentation. The chair moves that House File 3928 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Vang, welcome to the committee. We do have an author's amendment in our folders, so the chair will move the A1 author's amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Vang, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Samantha Vang. I'm here to testify on behalf of Representative Brands, who is the chief author of this bill, House File 3928. He'll be here shortly, so once he's here, I'll also step back. I also have another bill hearing shortly, too. This bill, House File 3928, modifies membership of the Health Department E-Health Advisory Committee and eliminates its expiration date, modifies membership of the Rural Health Advisory Committee, and establishes an advisory council on water supply systems and wastewater treatment facilities, and a health equity advisory and leadership council. And so I also have testifiers here with me today to who can describe further on these types of committees and if there's any questions.
Is our first testifier, Joko Farah, here? Yes, please come to the testifiers table. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Dr. Joko Farah. I am the Chief Information Officer for People Center and the co-chair of the Health Equity Advisory Leadership Council. The HEAL was modeled, just to give you guys context, the HEAL was modeled after DHS's Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council and was created in 2017. Under Commissioner Ellinger. In that time, we've had some powerful movements and a community. We've created a community-led advisory council consulting with Commissioner and agency leadership on how to embed equity into the agency's policy programs and processes. Our diverse council represents rural Minnesotans, Minnesotans with disabilities, communities of color, indigenous folks, tribal government, LGBTQ Minnesotans, immigrants, refugees, and more. As an external advisory body, we're able to hold MDH accountable and moving the dial and the needle to address health disparities in ways that the community has not been able to do before. Examples of what we've accomplished in this short time, our council members have dedicated over 750 volunteer hours to participate in these council meetings and conversations with MDH. We've advised MDH on their last strategic plan and the formation of the new strategic plan that's ongoing right now. We've reviewed MDH's grant proposals to ensure that they have an equity lens and are reaching communities that need it the most. We've consulted on the Minnesota statewide quality report and measurement systems and provided recommendations using an equity lens. We've issued a memo to Commissioner Malcolm and presented that memo that has had support from over 25 institutions across Minnesota. The memo highlights our top priorities for the agency, including community engagement, systems change, and data practices. We are now overseeing the implementation of those recommendations with agency leadership. None of this would have been possible without the existence of HEAL. The statute would solidify our structure and ensure that the agency implements the changes necessary to close gaps and disparities across the state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your good work.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3928? Is there discussion from the committee? Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want a clarification. The advisory, the Health Equity Advisory Council and leadership, it already exists, right?
It does.
It does. Okay, so we're just adding a member onto that council, correct?
What we're asking for is, I'd like to defer to MDH for the for concrete information, what we're asking for is permanence. Currently, that statute is in the Eliminating Health Disparities Grant. However, if that Health Disparities Grant goes away or that initiative goes away, the HEAL Council technically goes away as well. So what we're looking for is we're looking for permanence and no expiration date on the HEAL Council.
Madam Chair.
Representative Edelson.
And so that is looking at the expiration shall remain in existence until health inequities in the state are eliminated. That's the language. We just heard a bill on that, and I was just trying to find that. Oh, so that's, thank you. That answers my question.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, yeah, this is, so I'm assuming then, if it's part of a grant program, maybe it's currently in a session law, and this puts a section into a new statute. Is the language the same as it currently exists, or are there any changes?
Dr. Farah.
Yes. I'm gonna have.
I want a friend.
Lisa. A friend. I'm phoning a friend right now. Yes.
Please state your name for the record.
Hello, I am Lisa Timian, Legislative Director for the Department of Health. To clarify, so the HEAL Council was initially created by the commissioner. It wasn't by legislative an ask or requirement or request. So this is actually just a way to make sure that whoever the commissioner is going forward at the Department of Health, that this work can continue.
Okay.
Welcome, Representative Brand.
Thank you. I still have a master being two places at once.
It's challenging. Further discussion? There being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 3928 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, as amended, to the Committee on Government Operations. If all in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. House File 3928 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Morrison, would you like to move your bill and then proceed with your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 1591, which is an MDH policy bill that will bring the Minnesota Cancer Reporting System into compliance with CDC requirements by allowing Minnesota to share cancer registry information with other state-based cancer registries, the CDC, and with the National Cancer Institute. Cancer is the leading cause of death among Minnesotans, and 4 in 10 of us will develop cancer in our lifetimes. There are almost 31,000 cancers every year in Minnesota. Over 263,000 Minnesotans are cancer survivors. Yet Minnesota is the only state that is not in compliance with the CDC requirement and is susceptible to losing federal funding for the Minnesota Cancer Reporting System. Minnesota's 2 NCI-designated comprehensive care centers are required to have a state-based cancer registry system to maintain their accreditation. These centers receive over $74 million in research funding, which may be at risk. Sharing of cancer information with other state-based cancer registries is essential to identifying Minnesota residents who may receive cancer diagnoses and treatment outside of Minnesota and for ensuring accurate and valid identification of unique cancer cases. As Minnesota residents age and are living longer after cancer diagnosis and treatment, accurate information on cancers and treatment is important to better understand changes in types of cancer over time and the long-term effects of cancer and other health outcomes experienced by survivors. Sharing cancer registry information with other state-based registries, the CDC and NCI, are crucial for researchers to understand the impact of rare cancers and of cancers within specific groups of patients, such as children and adolescents. It also allows research to address health equity and disparities in high-risk underserved communities. Because Minnesota is not able to share cancer registry information, we cannot participate in funding opportunities to improve Minnesota's cancer reporting system. This includes becoming an NCI SEER state or more recently applying for the CDC STAR project to improve rapid case identification of pediatric, adolescent, and young adult cancers. And I do have one testifier, Dr. Logan Spector from the U of M, and MDH is also available to answer questions.
Dr. Spector, would you like to introduce yourself for the registry and go ahead?
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Logan Spector, and I work at the Masonic Cancer Center at the University. I'm here to support passage of House File 1591, which modernizes the Minnesota Cancer Reporting System and brings its operation in line with that of nearly every other cancer registry in the U.S. By way of background, I'm a professor of pediatrics at the U, who has studied the causes of childhood cancer for the last 20 years. Because childhood cancer is rare, I often must gather information from multiple registries across the nation to obtain enough data. Because of this, I may be one of the biggest research users of cancer registry data in the country, and I'm very well acquainted with their operation and capabilities. Much of what we know about cancer occurrence and survival is due to cancer registration. We know which cancers are becoming more common and in what areas. We know when survival differs due to age, sex, or race, ethnicity, so we can begin to achieve equity. We can do this with confidence because we count every case that occurs in state residents. Because we have a federated system of cancer registries in the U.S., data sharing between state-based registries and with the federal government is very important. For instance, is only by sharing that Minnesota can identify cancer occurring in snowbirds who are wintering in Arizona. To give another example, there is growing interest in preventing second cancers. If a first cancer occurs in a Minnesota resident who subsequently moves out of state, the Minnesota Cancer Reporting System would only detect the second cancer by data sharing. Lastly, the National Program of Cancer Registries also relies on accurate sharing of state-level data in order to assemble a complete picture of cancer incidence and survival nationwide in the United States. Minnesota's outdated law around sharing cancer registry data puts the quality of the cancer registry in jeopardy and puts us at risk for losing federal funding. Thus, I'm fully in support of House File 1591.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else from the audience that would like to testify? Okay. Then, members, is there discussion? Representative Edelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, it's been a really long day. I just want to make sure I get this right. Okay, so we currently collect the data, but we want to share it with other states. Is that correct? Is that what you're saying? Okay. I think that's fantastic.
Shall I respond? There's also a matter of reciprocity. So we want the other states to give to us. So if somebody got treated in Hudson but was a resident in Minnesota, we would like to receive that information because we're catching cancers of residents of Minnesota, wherever the cancer may have been diagnosed.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Morrison, is there already, will there be any cost to doing these changes that we have?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edelson, I do not believe so, but I'd look to MDH to confirm.
Okay. Dr. Spector, do you have, here we go. Good afternoon. Would you like to identify yourself for the record?
Hello, I'm Lisa Timian. I'm Legislative Director for the Department of Health. And no, there's no cost to making these changes. That's why it is a policy bill only, no cost.
Thank you. Representative Edelson?
Sounds like a really good bill then. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, or two of the testifiers. On page 2, lines 2.1 and 2.2, you reference a number of sections of statute currently, and I'm just wondering, we're sharing the data that is sovereign to citizens of Minnesota with other states, and I'm just wondering, under this bill, if that would be consistent with the authority already granted in statute 2 this organization.
Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, we're going to need to get back to you with the answer to that question. Representative Albright.
Okay. Representative Albright, it is going to judiciary.
It is?
Yeah.
Is that the next step?
That is the next step.
Hoorah.
Did you have other questions, Representative?
No, ma'am.
Albright? Okay, Representative Backer.
Representative Albright took my question on the data and judicial, but I do have one more question. So, specifically, what data, if it gets passed, would be shared with other states, and who would overlook sharing that data? Would that be the state of Minnesota, or would the feds be responsible with that data if it gets passed into law?
Are we looking for someone else to respond?
Sure. Okay. Let's call a friend.
Let's call a friend. Welcome. Will you please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Hello, I'm Jay Desai, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. And it would be the responsibility of the Department of Health who would oversee the exchange of that data and working in cooperation with every state that we are exchanging the data with.
Madam Chair.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. So right now, how many other states share this type of data? Do you have any idea?
We are the only state who does not.
Oh, so 49 other states do that.
And territories.
Territories, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions amongst the members? Oh, excuse me. Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 1591 be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails. House File 1591 is recommended to re-referral to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
All right. Representative Cantrell, I believe we are going to hear from you on House File 2052. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct.
So the chair moves that House File 2052 be recommended for placement on the General Register. Representative Cantrell, welcome back to the committee and present your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate you having me for a marathon session today. House File 2052 modifies the mandated health indicator report. So annually, the Commissioner of Health has to issue a report detailing the projected impact on spending of certain preventable causes of illness and such, you know, as a result of chronic illness or death. By February 15th each year, the Commissioner of Health then, by November 1st of each year, must issue a report detailing actual spending for each of the health indicators enumerated in statute, as well as any savings or contrast between the projected and annual and actual cost of these health indicators and overall health spending. So this bill removes tobacco use as one of the required health indicators and consolidates these reports while requiring their reporting on a biannual basis rather than on an annual basis and with separate reports. And with that, I believe I have somebody from the department who is going to come up and testify.
Okay. We have a testifier for House File 2052. Welcome to the committee, and would you please identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health, and it's been my team with a group of consultants that has conducted this work for a number of years now.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, just maybe a few words to explain this language. We, as part of this work, as part of the agency's work, we do a fair amount of assessing the impact of chronic disease in Minnesota, its prevalence, the cost, pockets in the state. The study in particular that we're talking about is taking a particular angle to helping our understanding of chronic disease. It is estimating the disease attributable cost of a certain condition. So instead of asking what is the cost for individuals who have diabetes, what is the healthcare cost, we're rather asking for everyone with diabetes, what is the proportion of the healthcare spending attributable to the disease? So it's an important question, but it's also a very, very targeted question, which makes it analytically a very complex question. We have found in doing this work that aside from it being complex, there have been some data issues that we've been challenged by, and some issues related to interpreting differences from one year to the next. So without going into too much technical detail, the data issues, the challenges with data issues is that to understand, for example, the impact of tobacco for Minnesota residents, we have to go to 3-4 data sources, some at the federal level, and some of them are based on survey data. So the sample gets fairly small. We have to roll data up across 3 years, and then doing it 2 years in a row gives us essentially the same data. It seems like a waste of resources and energy. The other challenge with data, particularly with tobacco, is that because the sample is so small, we can't speak to the cost attributable to healthcare needs for children and for people older than 65, and that could be quite considerate. So the data doesn't permit that for us. So what What we're anxious about is not misleading the public on the cost of tobacco by underestimating it, because we can't produce robust estimates. So that's with particular reference to tobacco. The other point I would make is, as we do this analysis year over year, we find differences in healthcare spending, and it's easy to attribute them to changes in the market, either prevention or differences in treatment patterns or diagnosis. In reality, because the numbers are generated through a complex modeling process, they incorporate compound errors and white noise from the data. So we find ourselves looking at year-over-year information and not being able to really interpret it, because more likely the changes are driven by the underlying data than actual changes on the ground. So our suggestion, therefore, would be to do this biannually so we can test more longer-term changes and give you interpretation about what we're seeing in the data.
Okay. Is there anyone else from the audience that would like to testify? Okay. Then is there discussion from the members? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I just had a couple questions. If the data has a lot of noise in it over the one-year cycle, is 2 years okay, or would you rather have 3, 5? Like, as a, you know, analyst, what would be ideal for you?
Mr. Gilstermeister.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a really tantalizing question. We, in the agency, we have had many debates around how to make this study better, and whether there were studies out there that are maybe more powerful in giving us results. The language before you is the position of the agency. I think if you found it appropriate to make the window longer, I think that might be further helpful. But there are also other ways of sort of thinking about what studies will bring us forward in our understanding about chronic disease and the healthcare costs that Minnesotans face. For example, the study doesn't really deal with the indirect cost of chronic disease, the cost borne by family caregivers, the economic cost of being away from work, et cetera. Those are important aspects to really understand how an aging population with a greater disease burden, what that impact would be for the state of Minnesota. So I think one way to look at this language is to see it as a start for a deeper conversation. And if you were interested in inviting that conversation, I think that might be useful as well. But the position of the agency is to do it biannually, but I think I could certainly make the argument to do it over a five-year period as well.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. And so I would like to invite that conversation with you and anyone else who would like to have it, because we want the data to be useful to you and to us. And so whether it's having the term longer, or whether it's also redesigning what we're requesting of the study, I mean, I would really like to hear from you and your team what would be helpful to you. So please, let's follow up. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gildemeister, I hear you on the difficulty of doing the part of the reporting that's on line 1.15 that's being stricken, having to do with utilization of tobacco. But I'm not quite comfortable, because it seems to me that that's one of the most important things we need to know. And so if we just take this out, are we getting that information somewhere else? Is there another way to get this? I mean, I just hate to say, oh, it's too hard to get this, so let's not get it.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think your question goes a little bit at the crux of all of this, in that this information is really important. I think the balance here that we're looking for is to ask, is having limited data better than, no, let me say this differently, is limited additional data to what we currently have better than no additional data to what we currently have. So I want to clarify that odd statement. We know a lot about tobacco from studies that are cross-sectional, that are done for example by individual health plans, and then oftentimes these studies are taken and generalized to a state, to an area, to the broader public. Those are the studies that we typically have right now, and they are fraught with complications in that they oftentimes don't adjust for comorbid conditions, for healthcare costs, unrelated to the exposure of tobacco smoking. They also oftentimes take into account that individuals who have been smokers have a higher chance of early mortality, so they fall out of the data effectively. Therefore, it makes some of the costs look less high than it actually does. So the temporal nature of the effect of the disease is really difficult to capture. I think the community has become socialized to a number of studies. You might be familiar with the ones that the Blue Cross Foundation has funded. Our study produces substantially different results because it takes a different aim. So to some extent, there is also a clash in methods, in approach, and in data. And I think there's certainly some in the camp who are saying, if you can generate estimates for the whole population, as we do with other studies, then this additional information creates more of a confusion than actual benefit. And I think that's what this language represents. But I think what this language also represents is that we have really limited underlying data to fully and accurately estimate the cost of smoking exposure. And it's not just smoking right now. It is smoking in the past. It's secondhand smoking. It is smoking exposure as a child. So those are, for each of those components, we have to go to different data sources and make a range of generalizing assumptions. And as we sort of build up these estimates, we have compounded error built into it that makes us kind of nervous about the veracity of the estimates.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gildemeister, I guess, it's kind of a simple little bill. It's a little bit of a tough thing, you know. And I guess what I would wonder is, would it make sense? I mean, first of all, if we're doing this now, even if we don't have the most, the best data, and it's limited, and you have to have three asterisks next to it when you report it and stuff like that, at the very least, we have some comparison year over year. And I'm wondering if it would make sense, instead of just eliminating this, to just do this one, like, less often. And, you know, with the, I just, once you take it out, I don't know, it'll be off the radar. I don't know. It's not really, I don't want to just lose this altogether, even though I hear what you say, you know, the use of the data may be limited. You know, all studies are limited, and they're just how much are they limited, and, you know, how many grains of salt do we want to take with them? So I don't know. I guess I just like some continued thinking about how we might continue to study this, even if maybe not as often, to try to, you know, make up for the fact that it's extremely complicated and maybe not that useful, you know, in a larger sense. But, you know, I assume that we've been kind of tracking this over time, so at least you have your limited data set, but you know how much change you're getting year to year. And I'd hate to just, like, not have that continue at all.
Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think those are fair points. Certainly the challenge of interpreting differences year over year has been a substantial one. We're looking at the data and we're saying, well, it's a 5% increase. Last year it was a 7% decline. Does that represent actual change, or does it represent, as I said, a sample difference in the federal survey, or sort of which year that we roll up together? Your point is well taken. Perhaps we can work with the author to find a way to accommodate your legitimate interests in having us contribute evidence to your discussion. Okay.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gildermeister, I'm just wondering, I'm going to follow on a little bit with what Representative Liebling said about that on 1.15. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if we are being short-sighted, not a derogatory observation, but with regard to the proliferation of vaping and how that affects tobacco usage and or the use of problematic imposters with the youth population, particularly as it still portends to use of nicotine. And I'm just, maybe you can respond to it, but it's more of an observation that are we missing out on an understanding of how the impact of legislation that's running through these committees with regard to that is missed or not being aided by the tracking of that through this process?
Mr. Gildermeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, another really good question. And we have sort of contemplated this in response to a question from the Attorney General who is pursuing legal means. Our understanding is, and we've looked at the data so far, our understanding is that claims data, the data we collect, does not quite let us look at vaping. It's not coded as a condition. It's not coded as a factor in healthcare cost data. And that is not to say that, A, it's an important question, and, B, we should pursue it. I think, and I'm not the expert on tobacco-related policies or even healthcare use, but my sense is there are probably better studies to do that are more targeted to identify the impact, the prevalence, and sort of factors around affecting both of those. So yes, absolutely agree with you. It's going to be a couple of years before we see methods to identify vaping in data. Sort of the federal surveys and the claims data need to catch up. In the meantime, there are probably other things that we want to do. And why don't I take that question back to the real expert at the Department of Health and see if they have some insight to share with you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Gildermeister, because in the rationale that I speak to on that is because of the corollary to the other issues here with regard to hypertension, coronary heart disease, coronary-related or otherwise cancers attendant to the use of vaping products, whether or not there's nicotine, you know, involved in that or not. I think it is in a holistic realm that, you know, we have to make these decisions. I think if you're not looking at the whole prism, you might be missing out on a very significant factor that would go unexplained otherwise. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. I guess I'm struggling with this one a little bit in how increasing the length in between data points is helping us sense trends. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure I follow the logic on how we're, by stretching those data points out further apart, that is actually solving our problem. It sounds to me like maybe there's a problem fundamentally in either the underlying data that we're collecting or there's some other barrier in the way that's, and I'm not sure that increasing the time window is necessarily how we fix that, just to be upfront. But I guess, and I'm wondering, you know, in terms of 1.15, just to go back to that, sorry, but I'm curious, what are the barriers? Are we, I know someone asked if we had other studies or other ways to get at this type of data that we could refer to, and we didn't really get an answer to that question. I'm trying to figure out, are we measuring the wrong data points, that we're not getting good data? Do we need to be reviewing what data points we're collecting or how they're being collected or the data source? Or I guess I'm struggling with how simply eliminating that is really the answer, and whether or not maybe it should just be a review of where the data is coming from, what we're collecting, which data points we're collecting to make it more useful.
Mr. Gildemeister?
Madam Chair, Representative Vanner, appreciate the question. I'm really excited by how engaged you are sort of in these analytic questions, because these are the questions we sort of struggle with on a daily basis. So with regard to the window, de facto, the way we do the analysis right now requires we take data from claims data sources from a number of federal surveys, and where we have limited data, we tend to roll them up into multiple years. So for instance, to get a robust estimate for individuals 18 to 64, we might roll 3 years worth of data up to estimate the cost, well, the prevalence of the disease and the cost for the condition. So that means we're sort of averaging a lot of stuff. And if you do that year over year, the same estimates sort of become part of your analysis. So you're actually not creating new estimates, you're not creating new information, you're just creating essentially white noise. So to your second question, are we measuring, do we have good data? I think the answer is no, we don't have the kind of data that we probably want to fully understand what drives prevalence, what drives the cost related to healthcare spending, the portion attributable to tobacco. It's a very precise question that you're asking us. So we are forced to go to federal surveys where the census needs to give our researchers authorization to touch the data, or our contractors. There are maybe 400 cases. So would it be better to have data that is specific to Minnesota that we collect ourselves? Yes, but it's also very expensive to undertake, and I can't imagine that we would be able to generate those resources unless we were sort of interested in generating really powerful data on, for example, tobacco or other chronic conditions. But I think, you know, oftentimes the data that we collect, that we use in the process of health services research or to inform health policy, is data that is a byproduct of delivering healthcare services. So claims data is, the purpose of that data is to manage transactions, to know who's responsible to pay what amount for what kind of condition. And then we collect sort of diagnostic information, make sure it all ties up and we can identify fraud when that is. So we're stuck with whatever data sort of comes out of the system. Rarely do we have the opportunity to really design the data to a policy question or a research question. So I think that's the case broadly in healthcare. It's probably the case elsewhere too, but if the legislature wanted to have a debate around what are the key questions that we cannot answer because of the quality of the data or the existence of data, I know the tobacco cessation team would love to have that conversation, sort of say, you know, here are the questions that we know, here are the questions that we don't know, here's what a research study could look like. It might be something that the health department undertakes, but it might also be something that would be really undertaken by, you know, by an organization like the CDC or National Health Data Organizations. It's a really important and big question that you're asking, and I'm giving you a so-so answer to it. But essentially, to go back to your initial question about does it help to extend the window, it does, because we are not tempted to interpret differences that we believe are more likely driven by price changes, the quality of data from year over year, and sort of the need to average data to come up with what we think is a reasonably rigorous estimate. So instead of, and then this goes back to a previous question, instead of looking at it year over year, looking at it over 2 years or 5 years would give us greater confidence that what we are actually looking at are trends rather than, as I say, noise.
Okay, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. You know, I don't need to kind of beat a dead horse on this one, but just, I mean, I understand this bill might get worked on a little more, but just regarding the tobacco issue, I mean, I would think you could do this without recreating, you could get some of this data without recreating the wheel. You know, I know that the Minnesota Department of Health every few years conducts a Minnesota Youth Tobacco Survey. I'm just looking at their website here. It goes, like, going back to 2000, it's been done every 2 or 3 years. There's a Minnesota Adult Tobacco Survey that's been done every 3 or 4 years going back to 1999. So, I mean, and these are, from what I know about these are pretty comprehensive reports. So I would think that would provide us a baseline that the Department of Health could use to evaluate costs related to the utilization of tobacco products, as the struck language would require, or does require, I guess, because it's in current law. So I guess I would just second what some of the points Chair Liebling made.
So it seems like we have many answers that we need to work on, questions that we need answers to, and with the Department of Health. So we're just going to lay this bill over as you guys work on some of the concerns. We're going to lay it over with the hopes that we can bring it back with some type of agreement. So thank you. So, Chair, we'll lay over House File 2052 for now. Thank you. So, Cantrell, we're going to move on to House File 2008.
Yes, Madam Chair.
The Chair moves that House File 2008 be recommended for placement on the General Register. Representative Cantrell, do you have an author amendment? There's an author amendment in our folder. And Chair would like to move the DE1 author amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The DE1 amendment has been moved. Okay. So the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Cantrell, please present your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 2008. This is a bill that specifies what constitutes appropriate lead hazard reduction activities. It requires individual certifications for lead hazard reduction work and clarifies the existing statute in such a way that emphasizes safety when handling lead within buildings. As everybody knows, we have a lot of old buildings in the Twin Cities, and a lot of places still have traces of lead paints. And whenever we think about kind of what is tantamount to safety, especially for children, is that we ensure that as this work is done, it is done in a way that is comprehensive, in a way that is correct, in a way that is accurate, is to mitigate and abate the lead that may exist within many structures in the state of Minnesota. So that's pretty much all I have.
Okay. We don't seem to have any planned testifiers. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 2008? Do you have any discussion from the members? Any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, on lines 1.5 and 1.6, you introduce a new term that I don't know has a definition, SWAB Team Services. Could you elaborate in terms of what is meant by that term?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. I have somebody who's going to enumerate that for us. Hi.
You.
Dan Lasher. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Please introduce yourself.
It's our first
nice
time.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Daniel Losher, or Lasher, for the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm a supervisor of the Asbestos Lead Compliance Program. The term SWAB Team Services is from the original statutory language, Representative Albright.
Right there.
And it's basically a type of service that does baseline cleaning in cases where lead dust or hazards are identified in a residential structure. And they typically are licensed and trained as lead workers. One of the examples in the Twin Cities is a nonprofit organization called Sustainable Resource Center. and they do what we call SWAB team services. The term actually came from, I think, Karen Clark when she was around. This is what they created as a unique occupational area for just doing cleaning versus full abatement, if that makes sense.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for that. We heard in this committee, I think yesterday, the day before, a Fisher bill that talked about lead abatement and remediation services. So I'm wondering, with regard to the language that's included in 1.9 through 1.11, if that in any way, shape, or form is in conflict with the Fisher bill that would be relevant to lead abatement regarding water gremlin?
Representative Cantrell, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I am not aware of the overlap between this bill and Representative Fisher's bill. I don't foresee there being an overlap.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I believe is that House File 431? Or 13? Yeah, there is a little bit of overlap, just to clarify, with the definition in Subdivision 17, lead hazard reduction. Ours is a separate amendment to that. What they're doing under their definition in that House File 4013 is adding a section on addressing other hazards during a risk assessment. I don't have that in front of me, but that's my understanding of that provision and that proposal.
Representative Albright, you have another question?
I'm just looking for exogenous events. I just don't want us to be duplicitous in our efforts or contradict what we heard yesterday. So to the extent that that testimony is on the record, I'll rely upon it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is any Chair Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to delay things here, but Representative Cantrell, I didn't really understand what the bill is doing. What is this bill? Could you just give maybe your testifier could just, why do we need this bill? I've been just sitting here reading it and trying to figure out what is it changing.
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative, what the bill essentially does is modifies certain elements or language within the current statute, so it aligns with our current rulemaking efforts to adopt a federal program called the Renovate, Repair, and Paint Regulation. And in developing those rules, we found there are some incongruities with some of the terms. One of the examples is they call it de minimis level, if you're looking at that, within the section on lead hazard reduction, which is amended under Subdivision 17. We had to move that to that area from the term regulated lead work, because it's not congruent with the term renovation, which has a differing de minimis level, which is currently under the Environmental Protection Agency. So we had to create two separate de minimis levels. As written right now, it's only one de minimis level, and therefore, if we try to take this program on, we will not receive full authorization from EPA.
So, Madam Chair, if I could just follow up real quick. So thank you for that. So, so this is not either regulating something that isn't regulated or stopping regulating something. It's just technical,
it
sounds like. All right, thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, if you wouldn't mind staying for a moment. So my understanding is that currently people have to have a certification to do this work, and now it will require that if they already have that certification, do they need additional certification for this specific activities, or does the existing certification cover this change?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, what this does essentially is clarifies the existing certification, which is a little confusing here. Under the lead regulations, under EPA, there's lead abatement or lead hazard reduction for renovation. It's all based on intent, and subsequently with renovation, you incidentally disturb lead paint. We're adding that. We already added that definition in, and what this does essentially, it's already a rule. The statute doesn't change anything in terms of certifications. They are two separate certifications for each regulation. part of the proposal actually clarifies which regulation you follow based on intent. So that, I think this is what you're getting at, is you don't have to have two different certifications and wondering what do I have to apply for a given project. There's a lot of confusion right now within the renovation industry as far as what certifications people need based on written specifications that aren't very clear. And especially in the renovation world, they use the terms lead abatement, renovation sort of interchangeably. So the goal of this proposal is to clarify that so people have a clear direction which regulation to follow.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I hope they are more clear than I am, honestly, because I'm confused. But just to be very clear, if people currently have certification in lead abatement, they don't need additional certification under this change.
Mr. Losher.
Yeah. Representative, or Madam Chair, Representative Robbins. No, it does not change current lead abatement professionals in industry. That the fees are the same, virtually what they do is the same. But what it does is clarifies what the renovators that in the renovation industry, what certification they will need once the rules are adopted.
So they may, I'm sorry.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for these particular activities, they may still need additional certification.
Mr. Losher.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, if they choose to enter into renovation, then they would need a training as a renovator to be as part of a renovation activity. If they're doing just lead abatement, it doesn't change anything.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, so there being no further discussion. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to be a stickler, but to the testifier or to Representative Cantrell. So on lines 1.12 through 1.15, why are we making a distinction about the size of either exterior surface or the interior room? Is this to avail property owners to do it themselves? I don't understand why we're making a distinction in terms of the quantity of work that is needful of remediation.
Mr. Losher.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, this is set forth already in statute and also aligned with the lead abatement standard for EPA. These de minimis levels basically determine when the work becomes regulated under lead hazard reduction. So it needs to be distinct there for that purpose when a certified firm doing lead hazard reduction or abatement knows that they would have to notify and follow the prescribed practices set forth in the current lead abatement rule.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Anyone from the...
No.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. So there being no further discussion, the Chair renews her motion that House File 2008 as amended be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and House File 2008 as amended is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you. Okay, Representative Cottrell Day. For House File 2910. Okay, the Chair moves that House File 2910 be recommended for placement on the general register. Representative Cantrell, please present your bill. We also noticed that you have an office amendment. So I will move, the Chair will move the A1 office amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion is moved. Representative Cantrell, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for indulging me on one final bill today. What this bill does is it changes the terminology and statute for respiratory care practitioners from respiratory care practitioner to respiratory therapist and requires that respiratory therapists obtain a registered respiratory therapist or an advanced level respiratory therapy credential through successful passage of these respective examinations. In order to practice. This is in keeping with industry standard. This is supported by the Minnesota Society for Respiratory Care. And some of the rationale that they give, they did publish a white paper, is that moving to the registered respiratory therapist is a minimum competency increases the safe and practicable utility of Minnesota's respiratory care practitioners for all healthcare consumers, ensures that there's a good kind of floor of competence in order to practice in Minnesota, overall kind of, I think, secures greater patient safety. When I was going through my chemotherapy treatment, I had to see a respiratory care practitioner, or hopefully will soon be a respiratory therapist, quite frequently, and she was phenomenal. And, you know, I appreciate the work that that these folks do, because it's it really kind of takes our breath away. So, Madam Chair, if I can give it to my testifier.
Yes, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Cantrell. My name is Kurt Merriman. I'm a respiratory therapist. I'm here to testify representing the Minnesota Society for Respiratory Care, and I appreciate this opportunity. Just a little bit of background. So presently we have about 2,000 licensed respiratory therapists within the state of Minnesota. And as some additional background to that, 80% of those licensed respiratory therapists are employed by employers that require the RRT, the Registered Respiratory Therapist credential, for employment. So one of the things that this bill does is it allows for a standardization, increased capacity or increased competency for the remaining state facilities where the therapists are working out of. We, at this point, do not see or have not heard of any opposition to this change, and it coincides with other advancements of other healthcare professions, as registered nurses, physical therapists, and just improving the competency that reflects the kind of work that we're actually performing on a daily basis with our patients.
All right, thank you. Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on 2910? Okay, members, have any questions? Chair Liebman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what do respiratory therapists or respiratory care practitioners have now for, I mean, this is already a licensed profession, I understand. And so I understand that the bill is kind of increasing the level of demonstrating competency in order to be licensed. So I guess the question I would have is, what do they have now, and why is that not enough?
Mr. Merriman.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, great question. So presently, our license requires that the minimum standard is to be a certified respiratory therapist and to hold that credential from the National Board for Respiratory Care, which manages all the credentialing within the profession nationwide. The registered respiratory therapist is also governed by that same organization and has been considered an advanced standing credential. With the changes over the number of years and the medical complexity of our patients and the areas that we're working, the level that the respiratory therapist is functioning at truly does fall more under what a registered respiratory therapist does. So it's just increasing the recognition of how we're practicing and a standard of care. Our National Association of Respiratory Care is targeting and is promulgating that by the year 2030, all 50 states will have RRT, that registered respiratory therapist, as the minimum standard versus the certified respiratory therapist. Presently, we have six states that already are doing this now with the RRT as the requirement for licensure. We would be number seven if that's the pleasure of our legislator legislation, and there are a number of other states that are working on it as well at the present time.
Okay, Chair Liebman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm a little bit more confused, because I thought are they currently a respiratory therapist then currently licensed, or are they? You said they're registered. There's a certified level. There's a registered level. Are they actually licensed?
Mr. Merriman.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we are licensed. The two certifications, and this is partially some of the rationale for doing this to clarify and to make it simpler across the board, but there are two credentials that the National Board for Respiratory Care administers. One is the certified respiratory therapist, which had been the minimum requirements and is presently the minimum requirement, and then the registered respiratory therapist as a national NBRC credential. But we are, yes, in fact, licensed by the state of Minnesota.
Chair Levin. Okay, Madam Chair, thanks. I mean, I guess I almost kind of don't even know what to ask here. I'm just not really sure why this is something that needs to be put in law. I mean, anytime we increase the level of licensure or certification or whatever of a profession or increase the requirements for that, we're fencing out somebody. And that's not, sometimes that's fine. I mean, this should be about patient safety. You know, if it wasn't about patient safety, there'd be no reason to license anybody. So I guess I'm just not really sure. I mean, it's fine. I recognize, especially we just had a hearing on, you know, COVID-19. I mean, there could be lots of reasons where respiratory therapists are going to be on the front lines and very important. And, you know, I don't doubt that they need a high level of competency. I'm just not really sure what we're doing in law here and why we need to do it and who is on the downside of it, because somebody's always on the downside.
All right, we have a testifier. Maybe you can respond to our questions or statements. So please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Molly Quinn Jensen, and I am the program director and professor for respiratory care at St. Catherine University and co-chair for the committee that pushed the RRT for entry to practice. Our bill includes what we consider a grandfather clause, so anybody that's currently licensed in the state of Minnesota will remain licensed in the state of Minnesota and is eligible for licensure renewal. And so we're not asking anybody that's currently licensed to elevate their credential or be out of work. The second portion of that is the two exams, the CRT, which is the initial exam, which is currently the only one required for licensure, is what it's a multiple choice exam. And so we present that to our respiratory therapist as you are provided the correct answer. You just have to select it. Versus the registered the RRT is what we call a simulation exam. So the people sitting for that board exam are put through a series of simulations in which they have to choose the way to treat the patient within the simulation. That being said, the simulation exam is more appropriately representative of what we do and is a better assessment of our competence at the bedside. And so we feel that elevating to RRT for entry to practice is a better representation of the competence that is required to keep our patients safe at the bedside.
Now, one final, thank you, Madam Chair. One final little question is, does this have any impact on billing or on ability of the practitioners to practice independently, or does everybody kind of stay in the same practice settings and the billing's the same?
Ms. Marion.
Madam Chair, Representative, great question. At present time, respiratory therapists are not billing separately to any third party, CMS or other insurances. We are a service of the healthcare organization that we're working from. In the event there are some telehealth bills nationally that would allow respiratory therapists to be providers of care via telemedicine for CMS and reimbursed for that, those requirements would be an RRT and likely a baccalaureate or higher from an education standpoint as well, to be consistent with other reimbursable healthcare professions. Okay.
Thank you. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the change in exams from CRT to the RRT, is there any change necessary in the required education to take those exams?
Ms. Quinn.
Madam Chair and Representative, no. Currently, all of the accredited universities or colleges that produce graduates that are eligible to sit for the exams, they are accredited by the Coalition for Accreditation for Respiratory Care, or COARC, and those regulations or accreditation standards state that we are required to prepare students to sit for that RRT exam.
Thank you.
Okay,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so Madam Chair, Representative, or maybe to your testifier. So, I mean, Representative Liebling is starting to, like, you know, trying to understand all of these pieces of legislation. It's a little. So the RRT, you're saying other states are moving to the model. Did you say that? Moving to the model of using more of the RRT? I think it's really important. I mean, first of all, I've had three kids that were intubated that, you know, we use respiratory therapists. And so the job you do is incredibly important. I understand the idea of using a simulation instead because I get it. So other states are moving to RRT, is that correct? And if universities, the training that currently people are getting are preparing them for that RRT. So essentially we're having them come down, they're ready to do the RRT, but the CRT is the older model that, if you just, clarification, that's, I have that right.
Ms. Quinn.
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative, the CRT and the RRT are both current exams. The CRT is just the what they consider an entry-level exam in its current requirement for our licensure. And so the RRT, or the registry exam, is what was traditionally considered as an advanced exam. But what we're finding now is with the up in technology and need for knowledge bedside, that is more appropriately representative.
Representative Adams?
So essentially, possibly best practice. Can you just tell me, out of all of the respiratory therapists that we have in the state of Minnesota, how many have RRT versus the CRT right now?
Madam Chair and Representative, that is about 60% currently have the RRT. Approximately 80% of the respiratory therapists working in the metro area are employed by companies that require them to have the RRT within 1 year.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more question. Are companies or hospitals, like my children were at Children's Hospital, are they paying for the respiratory therapist to get this additional or take this additional test?
Madam Chair and Representative, that is unique to each hospital standard. So the policy is not specific, like there's no standard there. It's whatever the hospital policy decides. But typically, if the hospital requires it, they typically do at least reimburse it if the therapist passed the exam.
Representative
Madam Chair, one more question. How much is that test?
Madam Chair and Representative, the exam is approximately $300.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers or Representative Cantrell, I'm listening to this testimony, and one of the things that I'm kind of in a quandary about is on the document that was included in our packet. It talks about, you know, the why and the wherefore, and out of the rationale, a couple of things jumped out at me, and I'm hoping that you can respond to those. And I do have a couple of follow-on questions, Madam Chair. But it says moving to the RRT as a minimum competency will ensure the competent practice of RCPs, increasing safety and quality care for patients in Minnesota. And the bottom one, decreased respiratory care board disciplinary intervention and associated costs. So I guess my first question is, is there a problem with safety right now?
Mr. Marion?
Madam Chair, Representative. I think anybody who works in healthcare, there's always a potential for issues. We do not have any specific issues that have been brought before the Board of Medical Practice, to the best of my knowledge, that's public information to indicate that there is a problem from that standpoint. Making this change is more of a reflection on how the current practice of the respiratory therapist is functioning. And at the same time, as my colleague Molly had mentioned, does not eliminate somebody from the workforce as well, that they would be grandfathered in. It is a standard that we would like to achieve across the board, both for not only for our state, but for our national organization as well.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the comment, but it still strikes me as one of your main five bullet points on the bottom of this sheet is to decrease disciplinary intervention, which, I'll be honest, was not addressed by your answer. So with that being said, I share Representative Liebling's concern, and I'll cite two words that raise concerns for me, and it's probably the same that have been shared by other members, and they're on 5.5 and 5.6, where you're striking the word certified and you're moving to the word registered. And for us in the room that have been here long enough, we recognize that as an elevation of the acumen and the profession itself. And quite honestly, when I look at those two words without the commensurate other language that typically is in a licensing bill, which I think this maybe, you know, infers, you're building new fences, which are legitimately, whether with all due respect, I think are going to potentially lock people out of the profession without further training and or certification by virtue of those one word stricken and one word added. And I'm hoping you'd be willing to respond to that.
Ms. Quinn or Mr. Marion?
Madam Chair and Representative, we're licensed by the state of Minnesota, and I apologize if I'm not understanding your comment correctly. We're licensed by the state of Minnesota. Our credentialing is national and comes from the National Board of Respiratory Care. And so I don't, with our grandfather clause, I don't believe that we're fencing anybody out that's currently licensed by the state of Minnesota. And currently our programs within the state of Minnesota are held to the standard to educate and produce respiratory therapy graduates that are educated to the RRT level. And so although we are in essence elevating the requirements for minimal entry to practice and licensure within the state of Minnesota, it is effectively standardizing what is happening across the country and bringing us into a line with the American Association for Respiratory Care to ensure patient safety and to prove minimum competence at the bedside as well.
Go ahead, Mr. Marion.
Madam Chair, Representative, and just as a addition to Molly's comments, the way the current national testing is done by the NBRC is that the candidate, depending on the high or low cut, when they take the multiple choice test, has the option to, if they make the low cut, which is the CRT, or if they make the high cut, which is RRT, they can decide then if they want to sit for the simulation if they meet that high cut. So this would, in fact, just encourage them to enter into the simulation, which they've been prepared for by our education organizations, our colleges and universities.
Just a final question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and this goes to maybe another motivation for this, but when you take a look at the CPT codes and or for the reimbursement rates, is there a distinction or difference between whether or not the reimbursement or the procedure was requested and then reimbursed for based upon whether or not a certified or a registered respiratory therapist or a registered care provider when you bill for it?
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed to respond to Representative Albright's question.
Hi, my name is Carrie Brass. I'm a respiratory therapist and I'm legislative co-chair for the Minnesota Society for Respiratory Care. And I apologize, I switched places as you were asking a question.
I mean, yeah.
So please.
So the point being is, and to the earlier question in terms of the difference between a RRT and RRCP, does the RRT, which would be the registered version of what we're talking about here, if you perform activities in a medical institution with an RRT, do you receive reimbursement at a higher rate than if you are a CRT?
The answer to that question is no. Respiratory therapists are not direct billers, so therefore our level of certification at this point is not relevant to that topic. It does not change any of our, we are not direct billers. So whether it's a CRT or an RRT is not relevant. I would like to just make a point of clarification, Madam Chair.
Yes,
and Representative, if I may. This, as the National Board for Respiratory Care, when I became a respiratory therapist many, many years ago, this truly was an advanced credential. This is no longer really, truly an advanced credential. Our need for our expertise at an entry level has now become what this test is. This test is essentially used to be two different tests. So the language of certified respiratory therapist and registered respiratory therapist was prior to all of the respiratory therapists in the United States being licensed. That is why those two words, the verbiage and titles, are there. The testing used to be two separate tests. Now with the National Board for Respiratory Care, who does the testing, it is one test. If an individual passes at a higher percentage rate, they have to meet a certain percentage rate, they automatically get the RRT credential. And we are simply saying that we need those individuals practicing across the state of Minnesota as they're coming in as new graduates to be all on the same page. The level of competency for each one of those individuals needs to be the same for the safety of the patients and to prevent and reduce any disciplinary action that could potentially occur from someone who does not have that level of expertise and demonstrating that competency.
Thank you.
Does that help clarify?
Representative Albright?
And to the testifier, yes, but I think it gives evidence to the line of questioning that we've all shared around this because it is a confusing topic. And while we deal with language, you deal with it on a daily basis, mm-hmm. so I can hope you mm-hmm. can appreciate our not antagonistic, but just
Absolutely.
Trying to understand, put our arms around what's going on here.
Madam Chair and Representative, we are absolutely grateful for the opportunity to come to you, for you to hear this, and for us to be able to hopefully answer those questions and clarifications. I certainly am a respiratory therapist and not legislative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, like Representative Adelson, I've worked very closely with respiratory therapists as well as a caregiver. And my concern with this right now is that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the testifier indicated that there have not been disciplinary actions. Is that correct? You said that would be public information and there have not been those?
Mr. Marion.
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative, there have been disciplinary actions. I guess I was not quite clear on the questioning with the verbiage that you're referring to. But yes, there have been in the past.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is, the real critical point back to what Representative Liebling indicated is the critical issue here is patient safety. Currently, are certified respiratory therapists capable of providing the best, safest care to patients? And if not, then perhaps there shouldn't be a grandfather clause. And then we run into the fencing issues. But if there's a reason that we need this for patient safety, then we need it. And if we don't need it, then that's a different issue. Does that make sense? So how do we reconcile that?
Madam Chair, Representative New, what we're trying to do here is be proactive, not reactive. Take a look at where the future of the profession is going and where, in fact, in many states it has already been addressed as standard, and ensure that we're implementing moving forward best practices in the state of Minnesota. I think, you know, this reminds me a little bit about how we used to have diploma nurses, but we don't see too many diploma nurses anymore, and then used to have then you had associate's degree level nurses, and now there's not a ton of those anymore, and so on and so forth. So it is kind of the advancement and the elevation of the profession that we're trying to ensure that, you know, as we have had CRTs who have learned on the job, right, through the course of their experience and from their colleagues, how to be effective in the profession. I think what we're more so looking at here with this bill is ensuring that that there is kind of that higher standard moving forward. So this is one of those things where it's a little uncomfortable because we're trying to bridge what used to be the standard and kind of where the profession is moving to ensure best professional practice and patient safety is kind of at a baseline level. But I think that my testifiers, if they have anything to add, I think that current CRTs, as much as they have learned and they have practiced within their profession, where we're trying to move is kind of that more elevated professional baseline for practitioners moving forward.
And I haven't heard, I think Mrs. Brass was really, I thought she was really clear about where we're moving. I didn't hear it had anything to do with safety. So maybe if you can come and just respond, give us some clarity about why we're doing this bill and how we're trying to align the standards of where you're going. Would that be okay, Representative New?
Yeah,
because I don't think it's about safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My feeling is that if it's not about safety, then it's superfluous. There isn't an actual need. And I guess my concern as we're going over this is that we've got a solution here in search of a problem, and I'm not sure that that's always the best way to legislate. But again, if there is a patient safety issue, that should be dealt with, and that should be dealt with now, not just in the future.
So, okay, Representative Pinto. And then we're going to move on.
Okay, Madam Chair, I just want to follow up on a comment made earlier that it sounds like if you get an education in Minnesota, become a registered therapist, it sounds like, or respiratory therapist, pardon me, it sounds like this is already the credential that you will be aiming at. Is that, I mean, so kind of if you're joining the profession now, you're getting educated in our state at least, you're going to be hitting the RRT, the standard we now are getting at. So I guess that, maybe I'll just, I'm seeing nods, I'll just say, that gives me some comfort on this then to per Representative Cantrell's point and in response to Representative New's question, that kind of this is where the profession is going. We've actually already decided that the educational path in Minnesota for this profession is this. Mm-hmm. So now we're just confirming that and saying if you didn't have that path, we're going to let you keep on going. But overall, we're aiming higher just as we are in educational setting. So, okay, that's helpful to me. Thank you.
Okay, with that, there been no further discussion. The chair renews her motion that House File 2910, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails, and House File 2910, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We have one last bill.
Oh.
Good? We are adjourned.